Hi, this is Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com and Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. I had the opportunity tonight to talk to Matt James, a freelance writer for Wizards of the Coast and the webmaster for Loremaster.org. The topic of our conversation was dealing with the power creep that exists in D&D 4th edition ever since its release all the way up through now. Where did this power creep come from? How can you deal with it in your own game? What are some of the effects that it could potentially have on your game? And what are the ways that you can deal with it without ruining the fun that your players have in optimizing their characters? So this is a 1 hour talk, and I hope you enjoy it. So I thought tonight we would talk about things, and I don't know exactly how to scope the topic, so maybe we'll figure out exactly what to call this thing. But essentially, it's how do we fix the warts with 4E? Yeah, and with a particular focus on class, not class balance, but like, you know, player versus monster balance.
Okay.
But also a little bit about, you know, there's a bunch of weird things that have kind of shown up in 4E,
right.
Like critical hits and like a lot of interrupts. And,
right.
You know, there's a bunch of different things, weird, and then, you know, what seems like an infinite number of power combinations that create effects that some might argue trivialize battles. So
right.
I thought you and I, you, Matt James, and I would talk about, you know, where did some of those come from? Why do they exist? What are the issues that surround them on both sides? You know, because it's not an easy topic. It's not something where you can just come up with a set of house rules and then you're all set, because part of the difficulty is that players really like finding those combinations and like using those combinations,
right?
And you don't want to take that fun away from them, but you don't want to watch your, you know, the story of your game, you know, disappear because they manage to stun a solo 5 rounds in a row.
Correct.
And then killed it. So what are your thoughts about this? What have you seen? How do you feel about it?
With anything good, there's obviously going to be bad. When fourth edition came out in 2008, and I want everyone to know, I have no specific insider information on, you know, the designers when they were creating fourth edition or anything, but I think that one of their goals, whenever they were up at their whiteboard coming up with goals for the next edition, was to create better synergy within the game because of the unbelievably rampant, unbalanced third edition. Now, granted, you know, the more books that come out and the more content that comes out, it's going to open up a lot of these issues. And I don't think that fourth edition is perfect by any stretch of the imagination, as listeners will come to understand when they, you know, pop this up. But fourth edition, it provided a lot more and balance in the ways that classes interacted with each other, with the way the different roles interact with each other. And it created an entirely new dynamic. And you're absolutely correct. There is absolutely people out there that derive their enjoyment out of crunching the numbers and getting, you know, making a science out of character optimization. And I think it's going to be a struggle for all role playing games from here on out. Mm-hmm. And I think it derives, you know, from people having better access to the content, people becoming smarter on the ways of how to figure out which is better and which is not. But I think not all hope is lost for Dungeon Masters, and hopefully you and I, Mike, can get into that and give some great suggestions.
Yeah, that's my hope. And yeah, I mean, what I want to do tonight is kind of talk about the issue itself. But I'm always about practicality. I don't want to just, you know, pontificate and then end with nothing. So I'm
right.
Hoping that between the two of us, we can come up with a few suggestions for DMs that face this problem and can deal with it. And again, I don't think there are any easy solutions to it. And it's, you know, nothing's going to fit perfectly. But there's probably a few options. I did a little bit of research on, and I've done this research before because I think it's some pretty staggering numbers. And you've probably seen these numbers before of the numbers of classes, races, powers, feats, items, paragon paths, and epic destinies that currently exist.
Correct.
And these are all just pulled from the DM compendium online. So it does include things like the multi-classes, and it includes, you know, things that are world specific, but the numbers are still really high, with 64 classes, 40 races, 7,791 powers, 3,066 feats, 9,014 items, 547 paragon paths, and 107 epic destinies.
There's 40 playable races?
There are 40 playable races. That probably includes the Monster Manual races.
But that still counts.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah, I think everything, you know, all of the numbers that I gave are all of the numbers that are potentially selectable in the character builder.
Cool.
So it is, but it's also like there is no solvable... You know, when you look at that and you think, like, how would you ever try to make sure that there aren't broken combinations among 7,700 powers?
Well, I'll let you know right now, it's not possible from a small team perspective. Believe it or not, I think it's a good thing that there are entire communities out there dedicated to finding these gigantic gaping holes within the system in the game. I'm still even surprised to this day when I bring up various combinations and things such as that, and some of the guys didn't really see it or don't know it, because in fourth edition, because it's completely an exception based system, the power and the combinations are always going to be there,
right?
And I think DMs have to just think creatively to come up with ways to mitigate how these things will dominate their game,
right? One of the things that kind of got me to want to talk about this particular topic, I knew I wanted to sit down with you for an hour and talk about something, but I didn't know what. And but Robert Schwab, who you know him, right?
Yeah, he's a good buddy of mine.
Yeah, I wish I knew him. Maybe you can introduce me sometime, because he's a personal hero of mine.
Okay, I'll introduce you as the guy that keeps leaving negative comments on his website.
Yeah, I don't.
That way you'll get off on the right foot.
That would be fine. However, an introduction, I'm sure I can charm my way out of it.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, but he writes wonderful articles on his blog. It's one of the blogs that I always immediately grab a cup of coffee or whatever and sit and read every word that he writes, because
as you should, because he is so integrated. Yeah, he is so integrated into the fourth edition system because of the pure amount of work he does for WotC as a freelancer.
Right. Right.
You should always recommend people check out his blogs.
So he wrote an article called "Stuck in the Middle" back on 25 April 2011.
That excellent was about, article.
Which we'll put in the show notes, or Dave Chalker will put in the show notes, I'm sure, and. The article talks all about this. It talks about the broken powers. It talks about a game he ran where he saw two particular combinations that triggered. One of them was a guy who could mark a target until the end of the encounter, and any target that he had marked was dazed and weakened until the end of the as long as it was marked.
Yeah, I think I used that in your campaign.
Did you?
And then I ended up with another cheesy build, but we'll go into that later.
But I think I had, even then, I think I knew that I needed to have something on monsters to prevent that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like I think it was like 12th level or so when I realized that dazes and stuns on solos were a problem, and I started house rolling, you know, some monster powers to get around that. I've been talking about that for a long time. But he has a couple of quotes in this article that I wanted to bring up, because they get directly to what you were talking about. And I think he very well articulates the problem that I've felt for a long time. He says, "Because 4E is exception based, there's no telling how many of these combinations just wait for exploitation. There are potholes all over the place, and each time we fill one, another one lies just a few yards down the road."
Yep.
Which, you know, I mean, that really gets to the heart of the matter. That there isn't, you can house rule each individual power, and it won't help, because there's just another one.
Right.
You know, right down the line. But this is another quote that I thought was interesting about how it has evolved. "At some point, perceptions about Dungeons & Dragons have morphed. The game is now winnable. Mechanical selection enables players to create characters that operate well beyond the expected boundaries and have the means to trivialize the opposition, thus forcing DMs to eliminate options and look for further afield for challenges to test their player characters. Optimal character construction has almost become the equivalent of the Ur-deck in Magic, and such combinations make the game no longer fun to play or run." So, I mean, I'm picking some, like, you know, specific negative quotes that he has in here, but they're, you know, I mean, I thought that, you know, I used to joke that I felt like I was playing, as a DM, I was playing five guys with blue decks, you know, and that they were just sitting there deciding what my monsters could do or how they could stop them from doing anything or how they could prevent it. And it's everything as simple from the ranger interrupts where a ranger can, you know, shift four squares away anytime a monster goes adjacent to him to, you know, we had a glaive master fighter where anytime any creature went adjacent to him, he got to hit it with his glaive and then take shift two. And it meant that he just ate minions. And it was an, it wasn't even an interrupt. It was a free action or something, or I think it was an opportunity action. So the only way I had around it was everybody had to ready an action until it was his turn, and then they would charge him. And that worked. But it was, you know, I had to come up with all kinds of crazy ways to get around this. So, and the hard part is it's kind of in the design of the game, that the game has it's an exception-based game. It's a game where each power alters the overall rule set.
Right.
So where combat rules can be described in, you know, 25 pages in the rules compendium, the true rules of combat include 7,700 powers.
Right.
So
the problem will compound and as time goes on and more powers are created.
Right. So you have a particular rule, and you have a rule that I like that I think we've talked about on Twitter from time to time.
Right.
For dealing with this kind of thing. Do you want to describe that rule?
Yeah, I mean, it's I kind of wrote it to be funny, but it's called the rule of the golden phallus, which I don't want to take 100% credit for. It was actually my gaming group back in 3.5 that came up with it because, you know, we were all kind of tired with people arguing with the DM and, you know, things like that. So we came up with the rule of the golden phallus, which states that he who has a golden phallus maketh the rules pretty much. And if you don't know what a phallus is, just go ahead and Google it.
Yeah, Google that, right.
It's phallus.
Make sure your safe search is on.
Yeah, don't do it at work. Actually, yeah. Anyways, it was funny when we created it, but it actually made a lot of sense. And as long as the DM wasn't doing something so specific that he was, you know, going after a player, you know, you generally just let it go and you move on and the next person goes and they take their turn. But I think one thing that is missing in fourth edition is a heavier focus on the dungeon master. Mm-hmm. In that I think more articles, content, and design principles should be feature the dungeon master to help guide them. And luckily there's websites such as yours, Mike, slyflourish.com.
Oh wow, I love it when you plug my stuff. Oh,
man. Awesome. That provides a lot of great information and a lot of ways to overcome some of these issues and ideas and suggestions. There's obviously plenty of sites out there that do that. But you dedicate yours to that, so I think it's a good place to go. But I think DMs need to start, you know, stepping up to the plate. And I think one of the keys that that DMs need to remember is they should set the ground rules as soon as their campaign or session starts or whatnot. And what this does is it lets your players know exactly what they can expect so that you're not making these calls on the spot and it looks like you're just trying to overcome what they're doing. So you kind of lay down the law there and you just let them know, hey, these are things that I think will help improve the game. This is the way I'm going to run it. So be aware of it now so that you're not surprised in the future. And when I do that, I find the players are, you know, they don't usually complain and it's not as big of a deal. And believe it or not, the people who complain the least are the optimizers because
they know
as soon as I mention that, believe it or not, as soon as I mention that, you can kind of look at them and you see their gaze kind of go off to the left as they're like, okay, this is a new roadblock, but how do I dump?
How can I optimize this? Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so they're happy, you're happy, the game is a little more enjoyable on both ends. And the story-focused people, they're not even listening at this point, you know. So they're just happy that there's going to be some semblance of balance, or at least, you know, the thought of it.
Right. So there's two things I've seen Wizards do in the past year. that looked like they were starting to in slow. I mean, one thing I've noticed about, I don't want to, you know, one of the things I don't want to do, and I don't do on Sly Flourish, and I try not to do on Twitter or anything like that, is ever talk about their business, because I really don't care.
I mean, amen, brother.
You know, we're both freelancers, so we care a little bit, but we have full time jobs too. So it's not
right.
Like,
but it's also such, it's at such a, it's at a level that is so far removed from the consumers or even freelance game designers that arguing about their business decisions just makes no sense.
And it doesn't help our games. It doesn't do anything for the enjoyment that we have at the table. So I try to avoid it. But one of the things that I still watch them, and I still watch what they do, and where I think a lot of times the community, and I use that term loosely, they kind of move back and forth really quickly. We have big ideas, we have big thoughts, we jump, we move. You know, a lot of times when we're doing house rules or we're coming up with new ideas, we move really quickly. But Wizards moves very slowly and very carefully. And they have an agenda, I think, and of specific things that they want to do to the game, specifically to 4E. And they have implemented it over time, very slowly, and with just minor little things that they've added into the various books. I mean, I think the most extreme one was probably D&D Essentials, where they had a particular new design for character classes that they wanted to put in place, and they did it by putting out Essentials. And they were always extremely careful to say, look, these are for you players who have played before, these are just new books.
Right.
And you guys can do whatever you want with these new books. But they also then made Essentials like the only books that you can use for their own Encounters program.
Right.
You know, so you'll hear some of the developers, some of the designers talk about their own games. And I know at least one of them has said, yeah, I only run Essentials now.
Right.
And, you know, you can understand why. And, you know, we can talk a little bit when we start talking about how to solve the problems of my game about the difficulty of trying to go to an Essentials only game. But they clearly have stuff in mind. And I think it was last Gen Con, I interviewed Mike Merles, and I asked him about things in the game that didn't seem to be working right and what they were doing to solve them. And the one he brought up was one that not only I noticed, but one that I noticed you capitalized on in my game, which is extended critical hits, the idea that you can increase the threat range of critical hits. And what he said was that, you know, It doesn't seem like a terrible idea to extend critical hits so that people can get crits more often and it's fun. But then when you stack that on top of all of the abilities that trigger off of critical hits,
yep,
and then you add on the ability that players are doing many more attacks around, you get this incredible burst of damage. You know, it's usually damage that you see that can occur. Do you want to talk about like an example of that you've seen or used?
My paladin in your game was a paladin who multiclassed cleric and went for divine oracle, which, as you know, they can use an action once per day to turn the next hit into a critical hit.
Right.
Now the problem with that is there's so many different ways of optimizing that with Righteous Rage of Tempest, which everyone thought was fixed, and I you know, calmly pointed out some aspect of it was fixed, but it's still pretty busted when used in combination. Now, Divine Oracle is one of, you know, as you know, is from the PHB1. And I think back when that was first designed, I don't think they, you know, obviously no, I don't think anyone really understood how Paragon Paths would work or how nasty that ability actually is. And I agree with you, Mike. I think that critical hits should be, you know, remanded to a natural, you know, 20 on a D20 roll to prevent that, because as you're aware, there are so many leader based abilities that can grant additional attacks. Not to mention you can be playing a striker that has additional attacks, and it's just a matter of time. You know, if you're rolling the D20 all the time, you're gonna hit the crit. And going back to that character I have with you, what made it particularly nasty is I could start forgoing powers that did a lot of damage because I was already going to do a lot of damage, and I could instead focus on status effects. So that's why after a while my character would automatically crit. You know, DM had nothing, you know, you couldn't say anything about it because that's the way it was written and that's the way it was. So I would crit. Oh, and by the way, you're knocked prone, pushed one square, dazed, weakened, and I can spend a healing surge, you know, whatever. Right. And that right there, that that's just, you know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. So I noticed there's a bunch of different things that caused a little bit of strife in my game. One of the ones that later on I had to completely redesign monsters around was warlords can trigger lots of different things off of crits. And in particular, they have a daily that they can fire off where anytime anybody critically hits, then everybody else gets a free basic attack.
Right.
And it happened every round. Like, it was very consistent. Every round they would pour out an entire extra round's worth of damage. And we didn't even have essentials characters at the time that did a lot of damage on basic attacks. But we had enough. And, you know, a lot of times those extra hits would crit too. And it, luckily, it doesn't chain react. But it was still pretty brutal how much damage would get thrown out. So I would have to do things like put damage shields on my guys. So every time they got hit, they did damage to everybody, or they did damage to whoever hit them. So right. That way, at least the party is taking a boatload of damage on top of the poor monster. Or I'd have to just put, a lot of the times I'd put skill challenges in the way, so they'd have to defeat a skill challenge before they could even start to do damage to somebody. And then they would, you know, beat them up in a round and a half.
Right.
But yeah, I would see just 900 damage in one round. You know, just incredible amounts of damage that would occur in one round.
Yep.
And yeah, and my solution for it, which has so far worked pretty well, but I've always had kind of pushback and rebellion, not rebellion, because how are you going to rebel against somebody who's holding the golden phallus? But certainly people that are kind of like, well, this really changes a lot of what type of character I would play, is when I put that rule in that said you only ever crit on a 20 no matter what. The only alternate thing is every so often you might find some terrain effect that lets you crit higher than that.
Right.
But there is no item or power or feat or paragon ability or whatever that will let you crit higher than that. And some people are legitimately said, look, not every power that lets you do that is evil. I mean, if it's a daily power that lets you do it once, you know, that's not going to cause this huge unbalancing effect. To which, you know, I say, yeah, that's fine, but I don't care. You know, like, tough.
Right.
You know, there's 7,700 powers. You can find another one. So, that's,
well, I think by limiting crits to a natural 20, I think that obviously, you know, barricades off a lot of issues when it comes to critical combinations.
Right. And the other reason I use it isn't necessarily from a power perspective. It's from a fun perspective, which is when critical hits become easier to get, they become less fun.
Right.
They're not nearly as exciting when everyone's getting one every round. So it's nice now to that you know, a 20 is something people really strive to get, and when they get it, they're very excited to get it. It's less like, I know when I played a rogue that just went into Paragon tier, and I selected Dagger Master because I don't know why you'd select anything else.
Right.
And I went from critical hits being this nice to have random occurrence to something that I could almost plan around. And instead of picking one weapon, I'd pick the one that had the high crit range, because I knew that, you know, one out of seven hits I was going to be able to get a critical hit, so I might as well get the weapon that gives me giant critical hits. And I don't think when you can design a character around the idea that you're going to get crits, I think that shows that there's something mechanically goofy. Another area that's interesting, Mike Merles wrote an article on his rule of three on Wizards just a couple of days ago. And one of the things he talked about, I need to pull up this article here if I can find it. There it is. So, and I'm just going to, I don't think it's a copyright violation if you read it out loud.
You're fine.
Yeah. So he says that he doesn't like the propagation of immediate actions. As a DM and a player, I hate that when the game is brought to a screeching halt as someone stops to figure out if they can use an ability, what that ability might mean for the action, and if it's even worth using at all. In theory, immediate actions are an interesting way to reward players for paying attention and focusing on teamwork, but in my experience, they cause tremendous slowdown at the table. That's a short thing that he said, but Robert Schwab wrote something almost exactly the same,
right,
called Reasonable Choices, which he wrote back in March. And again, you brought up the fact that, you know, that Robert Schwab has his head, you know, tightly wrapped around 4E.
Yeah, he's a bit of a psycho.
Yeah,
I hope he listens.
He thinks
to...
about this a lot, and it's clear. And again, as somebody who likes to think about the mechanics of 4E a lot, it's really interesting to read his stuff. And again, because he writes it so well, you really get an idea of what the problem is and what the issues are. And his thing was that there are just way too many interrupts that occur, and that it breaks. For him, it's not so much of a balance thing, although I'd argue there's still a big balance component to it when people suddenly get a lot more attacks per round.
Yep.
And a lot more options. A, your battles get longer, and B, suddenly the power scales quite a bit higher.
I have a big issue with immediate actions, and I think they slow the game down, and they open up a lot of other issues. But we can get into that later. I've got some solutions.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about this is if you start to look at the more recent PC builds in Essentials and also in Heroes of Shadow, you don't see a lot of them.
Nope.
That there's the two things that I looked for. There's a lot of interrupts are missing from Essentials and from Heroes of Shadow, and there's no critical hits, or there's no critical hits above outside of 20. And,
right, you can expect that there'll be nothing else.
Right.
I mean, I'm not speaking for WotC, obviously, but I can't imagine like we just went through, that you'll see much of that, if anything.
All right. Now, a couple of little tricky combinations that I've seen are still in the Essentials builds of the new fighter and the new Warlord Essentials builds. The Warlord is called I forget what the Warlord is called. The fighter is called a Weapon Master.
Yeah, I forget what the Warlord's called.
Yeah, and the Warlord build still had those little tricky epic level powers that let people get free attacks on crits, which isn't a big deal as long as no one can crit on anything but 20.
Right.
You know, it's not going to happen that often. I wouldn't mind it nearly as much, but I'm still scared of that power just because I watched it destroy a level 30 version of Orcus in two rounds. So I don't want to see that happen again.
Yeah.
My demon princes deserve better.
So,
anyway, you mentioned that you had some possible solutions for interrupts. What are some ways to deal with that?
And I expect I'm going to get some groaning in the comments of this podcast, but
nobody's going to listen.
Exactly. one of my solutions for that is having an immediate interrupt. Let the power stand the way that it is. However, if you use your interrupt, it's going to change your place within initiative order.
Hmm.
So if you take your immediate interrupt to do X, Y, and Z, that's fine. That's cool. You can interrupt and you save the day or you do something really awesome. However, it's not going to be – you're not necessarily acting on their turn. It's pretty much you've elected to forego your next turn because you're interrupting with this power.
Wow.
And it changes your place within initiative order. Therefore, you're not getting these crazy attacks from like let's use the Warlord and or maybe some power that is what was the one that my Paladin had, the Divine Intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. Like with this heroic moment, you dash and you kick the crap out of something, but it's not like, oh, okay, that was the monster's turn and I go next. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think by switching up initiative order, I think that's a good way of doing it. Another thing.
Have you used that in your game?
I actually have not.
I'd be interested. I'd like you to do that to watch your player's reaction before I try it in mine.
I'm definitely going to try to do that. And I'm thinking about combining it with limiting immediate action powers that a character can have. Meaning.
Yeah. Like you get one.
Yeah, you get like, yeah, so that way you can't build a character that's just got all encounter powers that interrupt and do crazy.
Right. Because I remember when I built a regular, you know, PHB 1 rogue that I specifically hunted down interrupts and reactions, immediate actions, because I knew that it gave me more things to do.
Oh, like, absolutely.
You know, I mean, and action, you know, actions are the true economy. The number of powers you have doesn't matter, it's how often you get to use them.
And by switching it up so that it moves you around in initiative order,
right?
One, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't cause exponential problems with the power, but it's also kind of neat, I think, in theory, in that it represents that character. For instance, say that rogue that you said that you just stacked up on immediate actions. You're constantly jumping around initiative order, which is kind of neat in a way if you think about it.
Interesting.
But you're not getting, you know, a crazy amount of attacks every turn because you're interrupting and then you have your regular turn and et cetera, et cetera.
But you would essentially be removing that person's move minor and standard, right?
Yeah. I mean,
they wouldn't.
Well, yeah,
if they interrupt, that's their round.
Right.
Yeah.
So they would have to decide, is
that interrupt worth blowing all the rest of my potential abilities?
Right. Yeah. And I think it's going to create a certain dynamic where characters are, you know, you're going to start people or you're going to start seeing people in this type of situation, I foresee, choosing, you know, it's like, ooh,
yeah,
I really need to interrupt this. Like, for instance, yeah, I need to save someone's life. This is the time to do it. Or, man, that guy, that big bad guy is about to drop. He's going to kick the crap out of the next person. So I'm going to go ahead and interrupt, get in there and finish him off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the only. I'll bring that up. I have a feeling that my players would completely revolt against that because they would just say like, I'll just never use interrupts because I'm going to lose a full round.
Or Mike, what you can do is you could have it interrupt, and then say it interrupts. They use their power, and then the monster finishes their turn. That's where the new player's turn is. However, they'll only have their move and minor left.
Yeah, right. So it count kind of is blowing in their standard.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Moves them within initiative order. That way it actually cuts down on the power.
I like the idea of limiting people's interrupts to, you only get so many interrupts that you can even have. So you couldn't have more than,
right,
more than one maybe or something like that.
If you want to get real funky, I like doing these real funky subsystems, you could have it be that you can only have a number of interrupts equal to your, wisdom modifier or something. I don't know. I mean, right. Just think of something.
I mean, one of the things that's helped me, interrupts hasn't really become a horrible thing in my game. I don't know if it's just the way our group has laid out and that we're used to it. But the other thing is, like, once I know that people have interrupts, I do, it's like magic, again, falling back to Magic the Gathering. You have the phases in Magic the Gathering, but a lot of people don't check every phase because you don't need every phase. You don't always need your upkeep phase. So you pass over your upkeep phase. You just go straight into your main round, right? But when you're learning and when you have really complicated decks, you need to stop at every phase and say, okay, it's the beginning of my turn. It is my untap phase. It is my upkeep phase. It is my draw phase. And you stop and say that. And I'll do the same thing where it's like, okay, monster's moving next to you. And then I'll look at the person and they'll look at me. And then I'll say, okay, monster is swinging. And I'll look at them and they'll look at me. And I'll say, okay, monster hits you, And I only do that if I know they have interrupts that can do something. But I'll make a point of trying to leave the hole there for people to interrupt.
Right.
So, and then some interrupts really aren't bad. Like, my wife, Michelle, her character, had a combined attack interrupt where when somebody hit somebody, she got to get like a free shot and hit that guy with an arrow. And that was really easy. Cause I just let her do it. And we, none of us would even stop the rest of the round. And then she would just say, by the way, I hit that guy for 30 on his turn.
Yeah.
And it meant that there wasn't any interrupt. The only interrupts were the ones that actually, truly interrupted the game. Like, the difference between a hit or a miss, or, the guy hits you with a shield and I use shield and I have +4 to AC. So he missed.
Right.
That, it changes the behavior of the monster. But even those, I don't know. That hasn't been that bad. I don't think that that's nearly, it's certainly a problem, and it's interesting to see Mike Merles and Robert Schwab bring it up, but those don't seem to be nearly as big a problem to me as the power, the weird broken combinations that, either completely hinder terrain or completely hinder a monster from being able to do what that monster was intended to do. Those to me, and that's, somebody got on my case on Twitter, not really on my case, but somebody, when I talked about balance and I said, I think that character balance is really important, and they thought I meant like one character needs to be as powerful as another. And I don't care about that at all, because I don't care about player characters. But what I do care about is when I care about the balance of the rest of the game. I care about when a group of five players with one type of character set is having a really hard time with something, but with a different type of character makes it completely trivial. That means that there's something going on, that even assuming that they have all the right types of characters, that they have all the archetypes are all there.
And I think that's okay in a sense. And I'll tell you where I'm going with that. I think, again, going back to one of my original comments there, I think we as in people who write for Dungeons and Dragons, need to suggest or need to create and design additional options for the dungeon master. Mm-hmm. Because as you well know, if they're dominating one specific aspect of the game, or one, you know, like, okay, this group's really great at taking out solos, there's we need to add things to the arsenal of the DM so that they can come up, whether that's hazardous terrain types, traps, hazards, mm-hmm. Unique monsters. As you're seeing now, Mike, since Monster Manual 3, there is a I think there was a pretty big empowerment of DMs with the way that some new monsters are being designed.
Well, yeah, the monsters got a lot tougher, and there was a lot more ways to deal. I still don't think they went far enough, frankly. But they certainly, yeah. I mean, you know, to me, there's a night and day difference between monsters that were developed from Monster Manual 3 and above.
I've noticed is that it's definitely making players think twice about the powers that they choose.
Yeah.
And while I agree with you, it's not perfect. It's definitely taken away a lot of the cookie cutterness, so to speak. But it still exists amongst certain groups that optimize a certain way. But I think that can be overcome not by adjusting the way that player content is created. I think it could be fixed through content for dungeon masters.
Yeah. I think there's a certain, yeah. I mean, I'm a huge proponent of house ruling on the DM side. I think that whenever a DM house rules, they should always say, how can I do this behind the screen so that I don't have to tell the players anything? And, you know, I've done things for years that way where, you know, monsters have abilities. You know, one of the more popular ones that I wrote about was they can take a bunch of damage in order to get rid of a status effect.
Right.
Called the brutal shake-off. I think that's great. Yeah. And you can do those and you can experiment with them. You can try them out. And if they suck, you throw them away and you never use them again.
If
you house rule for the players, now they have to remember a new rule. And then if you change it, then they're like, yeah, now you're just changing rules left and right.
One of the ones that I use in my I'm guest DMing for a buddy for a small series of events before he goes back to DMing, but I allow players to reroll an attack if they spend two healing surges. And
That's a good idea.
Well, I'll tell you what, their eyes lit up like little kids on Christmas. They thought that was just insane, and I was like, no, you know what, guys, go ahead and we'll try it.
It's gonna be hard. And
I'll tell you what, they were pretty much out, you know, very low or out of surges by the end of it. And to tell you the truth, I think most of them didn't even hit on the reroll. It's not like they get a bonus on the reroll.
Two surges and roll a three.
Yeah, they were, you know, so it added a you know, conflict. They had to decide if they wanted to use this valuable resource. And of course, the fighters and the con heavy guys, it was a little easier on them, but still, they're burning through surges, to, you know, and hey, chances are, you know, still the same that you're going to miss. So anyways, I wanted to throw that out before I forgot.
Yeah. There's one thing I wanted to go back to when we talked about DM control and DM, you know, DM power and the evil agenda, the agenda that Wizards has. And one of the things that I noticed they're starting to do is they are leaving more open-ended phrasing in some of the powers and some of the things they do. They did this in Gamma World, and I remember there was a lot of people that went, wow, that's a good idea, which is in 4E, there must be, I don't have a rules compendium here, but I think there's like two pages or three pages of material that describe cover. You know, how do you determine cover and what happens, you know, and one corner of their square has to be blocked and, you know, stuff like that. And it could have been really easy to you know, in Gamma World, they only had a short book. So what they said is cover is determined by your DM.
Yep.
And that's
awesome.
It's like a great weight is lifted on the world. And even the players are like, hey, that sounds, you know, I can dig that. And then the rule for the DM should be, and this is what I think, and this is what I tell players, that getting cover is easy. Getting superior cover is really hard.
Right.
You know, and essentially what it means is when you have cover, you can get cover anytime there's something between you and the other guy. But the only way you're going to get superior cover means that there's something so big that you wouldn't be able to attack him through it.
Right.
And that way it's like, yeah, you can get cover that way, but you're not going to be in line for an attack. So
exactly.
You know, so that really helps when you can just say, do I have cover? And you say, yeah. Or do I have superior cover? And you say, no, you don't. You got to be on the full side of the other building. And then that kind of puts it back in the hands of the DM. The other one that I saw in Heroes of Shadow is there are certain powers and certain poisons and things like that that the assassin had, where it said, if the DM allows it, you know, such and such happens, or such and such happens if the DM allows it.
Right.
And my big joke was that I'm adding that to the beginning of every single power now. You know, that from now on, anytime anybody does anything, I can add the words, if the DM allows it, on the end. And of course, that's our big joke, because I have no authority or no power over my own game. But I have no golden phallus. They took it and they cut it into pieces, and they all took a piece.
Well, I have to say that, yeah, you're a pretty forgiving DM, but you bring the heat during the encounter.
Well, yeah, so I try to pour it in by saying, yeah, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, throw Orcus and five guys, and, you know, by the room's on fire, and you've lost all your resistances.
You know, Mike, before I forget, talking about this made me think, too, if maybe you tied something to the interrupts or the immediate actions, like... you know, tying it to you spend a surge as well. That might help even things out.
Yeah, I'm you know, it's a good idea. I like, you know, trying to find some way. But the hard part is, like, how do you do that without becoming Mordak the Preventer? You know, where you are now the guy that's saying, like, yeah, I know you know, for the last 2.5 years, you've been playing right. A certain way, and you've had all of this stuff. And now I'm telling you don't have it anymore.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being an issue.
The thing that I've done to help kind of balance my game out is something that's been pretty unpopular, which is I've been limiting the source material that they can use for character creation.
Right.
So
you're up to like essentials now, aren't you?
Yeah. So when the Dark Sun, in the Dark Sun campaign that I run, I didn't make it essentials only. I picked a handful of classes. I think I said they can use PHB 2, PHB 3, and essentials, but they couldn't use and they could use splat books or the player, you know, the power books. But they could not use anything from Dungeon or Dragon, and they couldn't use anything from Player's Handbook 1. And that freaked everybody out, because they're like, "What do you mean I can't use Player Handbook 1?" I'm like, "You don't need it anymore." I'm like, "Any class that you want in Player's Handbook 1 now exists in essentials, except the Warlord." The Warlord was the only one. And of course, the problem is that because there were no divine classes either, that meant there was no cleric or druid. So that meant that the only leader was like the bard. You know, there was a shaman and there was the battle mind. There's a battle mind. Battle mind's a defender. I forget what the ardent.
Ardent.
Yeah. So, you know, they had a pretty limited set of leaders. And actually, that's one thing I noticed with essentials is they're missing a lot of leaders. There's not a lot of leaders from essentials and beyond. And right. They put out the Warlord, the new version of the Warlord. So I allowed that because I said, look, I was going to allow it anyway, but I also thought they were going to make more modifications to it than they had. And now the Warlord's back in, and he's pretty much exactly like the PHB1 Warlord, and he's making everyone else attack. And now he's got Slayers that are, you know, pouring damage out every round because they get to make three attacks a round. So, you know, it's something that it's still not perfect, but the game is a lot more balanced. They are threatened way more than they used to be.
Exactly.
Even at the same level, they're level 10 now. They were level 9 the last time we played, and it was, you know, it's been rough. Now last game they had two healers and three strikers, I think, and that was hard because there was so much healing going on, and they had so much advantages that they could offer to other players, and both of the healers had ways to make other people get free attacks. So our Slayer was very happy, but it meant, you know, it was pretty tough.
Right.
That's, you know, the one problem is I want to I think the way to kind of keep things balanced and keep those, you know, those giant numbers under control, the number of classes, races and powers and stuff under control, is by limiting source material. I think you just say, like, the design of player characters, you know, post essentials, at essentials and beyond, are better than the design of characters before. They run better at the table. They make the game more fun for everybody overall. There's a much greater balance between players and monsters. The challenge is a lot greater. They really have to think about what they're doing. They can't just steamroll everything like they've been doing.
Well,
but my players aren't real happy with it.
Well, you saw the same thing start to happen a couple years after 3.5 came out.
Mm-hmm.
it's just too much to worry about. And of course, in that system, it was a lot more that you had to pay attention to, but the same thing happened. You had to limit what sources were available, or else you're going to run into these insane problems. For instance, You know, I was running an optimized group through, you know, through some content, and they all took themes from Dark Sun. Why? Because it's stupid not to take a theme from Dark Sun, because it adds to your character.
Oh, this is for, no, in 4E, you mean?
Yeah, in 4E.
Yeah.
There's no reason not to take a theme.
Was it a Dark Sun campaign, or they just chose it anyway?
No, no, no. This was you know, this was a la carte. You have access to everything.
Oh, really?
What would you build?
So, like, and I got my dragon marked guy with my Dark Sun theme.
Exactly. So, so yeah, you absolutely have to limit what you're allowing.
Ugh. Yeah, I think so. And you know, people are they're kind of getting it, but I still get a lot of people are like, oh, I don't think there was anything wrong with the Ranger from PHP 1. I don't know why. And I don't like the new cleric. I like the old cleric. It's like, well, of course you liked him. He could heal everything all the time.
Yep.
And he had a burst 8 that killed everybody in the room. What's not to like?
Exactly.
But that doesn't make it fun for everybody, and that doesn't mean that the game is balanced around
well,
it.
So. Well, I think at some point, I mean, as a DM, you're just going to have to say, you know, I'm sorry, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, rule of the golden phallus, my friend. I have my reasons for doing it. If you want to talk about it after the game or over email, that's cool.
Right. But you're at the table and it's my table.
Right.
Right.
Oh, I mean, amongst my friends, I'm the biggest dick you can possibly be. But that's amongst friends. I don't recommend doing that with people you don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's
actually,
you know,
my
same
group,
as...
they call me the Jackhole DM.
Yes,
I think
I've seen it. I've seen the hashtag on Twitter.
Yeah, Jackhole, because I limit things. I don't let them get away with some of the most ridiculous things in the system.
Right.
And I'm known to be pretty brutal when it comes to beating up players, but at least it makes sense. And they have fun, and they just, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the hard part that I'm handling, like I'm, you know, we're probably 4 games away from the end of my Dark Sun mini campaign. I'm really big on the mini campaign idea now. Like I don't run long 30 level campaigns anymore. Instead, I'll run these 10 session mini things, and that means that I can change the source material around. I can even run a few that are totally open where you can play any broken thing you want, and you know, I can just stop the campaign and move to something else.
Right.
And that way I don't go crazy by saying like, wow, you know, like anytime. So my 30 level, you know, my 30 level campaign, I'm still going to do some 30 level adventures for it. And there's no limit. They can do whatever they want, but so can I. So, you know, that's fine, but I'm going to throw your character off a cliff. but I'm putting together a Shadowfell campaign for the Gloomrot, when the Gloomrot box set comes out. And, the limitations I'm starting with are you can play anything from either of the Essentials books and anything from Heroes of Shadow as a start. And then to begin with, and we're still figuring out whether or not this is a good idea, I was going to let them pick two races and two classes outside of that they could play. So that if they really want to play an Avenger, then, you know, they can play an Avenger. If they really want to add in the Bard, you know, they can add in the Bard. You know, my thing is like, that might be fine, but I might not allow the Weapon Master or the new Warlord, only because people seem to really gravitate towards that Warlord every time. And I want them to try new things.
Right.
But one of the other little tricks is that I'm trying to pick source material and I'm trying to pick classes that fit the theme of the campaign. So you kind of have a core set of character classes that you would expect, but then there's also like the Heroes of Shadow, which are very based on the Shadowfell.
Right.
So my hope is by saying, yes, you can't play anything from Player's Handbook 2 anymore. There's no Barbarians or Avengers or anything like that. But you do get to play Vampires, and you do get to play Blackguards, and you know, you wouldn't get to play those normally, and those are all new. So, you know, what I noticed is even in my campaigns where I left things pretty widely open, people still played a lot of Essentials guys. Because the Essentials guys have a lot of power behind them. They're simple, but they still hit like freight trains.
Right.
So so I'm still trying to figure out like the best way to kind of sell that to the group. And I think they'll just deal with it. They'll be like, that's fine. But I'll still get mumbling about like, yeah, but I really wanted my special warlord that had that cool thing that was in Dragon 369.
Yeah. Well, they'll hopefully they'll adapt and more importantly, hopefully they'll understand the reasons behind it.
Right.
And, you know, speaking specifically about your group, of which I had the pleasure of marauding around with, you know, they had a couple years, they had a good run at it, you know, doing things that way. And I can understand why they would be reluctant. I think some of my players will be reluctant once I start restricting things further. But at the same time, you know, I think it's important for everyone who's listening to remember that this is a game where we all get together and pretend that we're, you know, knights in shining armor or wizards shooting lightning bolts. And hopefully people will understand that that's what it's actually about.
Right,
so,
right. So what would you, let's jump into some tips and tricks for how to help keep things, you know, keep things balanced and help the game. You know, that's one of the things I noticed is in Robert Schwab's article. He's got some ideas about things you can do. You know, I haven't seen anything that's like real clear, like here are 10 things you can do. And if you put these 10 things in place in your game, it's going to be a smooth game that runs well, that your players will love, and combat will get shorter, and, you know, the fun will be there, and you'll lose weight, and, you know, everything will be great. So, but I'm trying to find what those are. You know, I'm trying to find, because like, I don't want to fill in potholes. I want to make a new road.
Right.
Not to overstretch and overuse metaphor. But so what are some of the things that you would do overall to help keep your game balanced? We already talked about, you know, limiting player options.
Well, like I said, what kind of going off of what we were talking earlier, I think the overarching thing that I was trying to get at is, you know, there's an economy, as you said, of actions, of powers, of everything else, that's very deeply seated within this exception-based game. So I think one of the ways to help balance things is to have a cost associated with the certain actions. For instance, the immediate actions being, you know, charging a surge for it or whatnot. And I think that's a way that you can start balancing things in a certain way, or, you know, even hit point loss if you want. But I think that's pretty important. Trying to think what else is important for the DM. The DM needs to take the time to research the different terrain types and their associated effects. And along that line, also traps and hazards. Because if you're just having a big chamber room and characters come in and they have to fight some nasty solo and there's nothing else really involved, that's where they're really going to shine, because they're going to start, of course, they're going to make those characters that are really good at taking out those things. However, if it's in the back of their mind that, oh man, there's more to this than me rolling my dice and choosing this power or that power, then I think it starts, you start molding your players. And I think you need to develop your players more than anything else. And hopefully content will be coming out that will help you start thinking, having that line of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still kind of, one of the things I'd really like to see WotC do is I'd really like to see them do more Unearthed Arcana that just didn't add more rules, but instead said, here's how you can filter and morph the rules that exist now to, you know, to kind of rebalance things. You know, I don't need more potions. I don't need more whatever. We've got so much material now.
Right.
But what I do, I mean, I don't mind when they put out new stuff that's well balanced. I am very much looking forward to the Heroes of the Feywild. I heard in open channels that the Heroes of the Feywild is going to have a character class that can actually switch its type from, you know, striker to defender or whatever. And I think I'd like to see more of those.
It's a pretty cool book. Yeah. That's all I can say.
Right. I'd like, you know, I want to see more, because I actually do that now. You know, I let, in order to keep, you know, some normality to the game, if people are in or out, I'll have people that are close to one switch to the other. So like the warlord can turn into a fighter, and that way he can be either defender or leader. And then the guy just keeps two character sheets with the same name and the same race, but two different classes with two different sets of powers. And on an extended rest, he can, you know, stretch out or whatever, and, you know, put on a different set of gloves, and now he does the other thing.
Right.
I think, you know, I've only instituted a couple of house rules in my game that were kind of big, like, you know, pave the road kind of house rules. And one was the no critting on anything but 20, which solves a lot of problems.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a little, you know, it's a little draconian, but, and it immediately makes a bunch of feats, you know, completely useless. And a bunch of powers completely useless. But I don't care. I think there's enough that there are enough.
Well, you got to sacrifice, and you're right. It does close off some options, but at the same time,
yeah,
like what you started out this podcast with, there are so many options that if that type of character or that player, I mean, can't find something to suit them, yeah.
then they were a little too tied too tightly.
They're not trying hard enough.
I mean, my big thing was like they would say like, well, it's really not that big a deal, and I go, well, if it's not that big a deal, you don't care that it's not there.
Exactly.
Like, well, you know, but
players are always
going
to try to sell their awesome.
Exactly.
Build,
right.
So.
Right. So. The other house rule is a smaller one, but I think it helps solve a mechanical problem overall, which is generally you can only take damage from getting pushed into damaging terrain once. So it stops like the zigzagging into firewalls and stuff like that. And there's a bunch of combos that exist. I saw it real early. I think I saw it level 8 where one of my players said, you know, I'm pretty sure I can kill any single creature you put on the map in one round.
Yeah.
With my wizard and my rogue. And the wizard puts up a firewall.
And
the rogues does a zigzag in and out of the firewall, so the guy takes damage 5 times. The other one was like dominating and then making someone run. You know, if guys in the center of 4 of your players, another player dominates the guy, the monster runs, and all 4 guys get opportunity attacks. And my argument was that they could then make a saving throw to fall prone rather than as though they were falling off a cliff, because you know it's equally dangerous.
Right.
The other big giant house rule I use is by limiting what material is it going to be available in any particular campaign. But one thing that I'm thinking about while we're talking here is that I'm still going to keep a God mode campaign around where it's all gloves are off. You can make anything you want. You can pick whatever broken stuff you want. And the challenge becomes, how do I keep you entertained and challenged,
right,
even though you can completely dominate it?
And Mike, you actually bring up a good point that I kind of want to take a minute to talk about, in that being optimized, or having a group of players that are optimized, that enjoy that doesn't make them less of a role player or anything. And I know this kind of goes into the Stormwind fallacy, but let your players do that. And it becomes now a challenge, not necessarily for your players, but now it's a DM. You have to find ways to overcome what they're doing, whereas usually it's the players overcoming what the DM created. So I think you can still find a lot of enjoyment in that.
Yep.
And I think it's good to do that from time to time,
right,
because a couple things happen. One, your players get to experience, you know, the optimization side, and the DM gets to experience. But it also creates awareness for the things that are, you know, possibly just unbalanced in the game or whatnot. So anyways, real quick, I just wanted to say that type of gameplay is not inherently evil, bad, or incorrect.
All right. I want to quote Schwab again. He says, optimizers do what they do because they enjoy the challenge and they live off to show off their creativity and, in some cases, their mechanical genius to everyone they play with. Coming down hard on these characters is either a blatant punishment or just incites these players to look for even more superior options, and nuclear escalation continues. I think, a big thing that I found is that they really enjoy making those guys. It's fun for them. And, you know, Schwab's point is that, yeah, it's fun, but eventually they're going to get bored, because, you know, going into God mode in Doom and trivializing the game is cool for about 10 minutes. And then you realize, wow, you know, when I kill a cyber demon with a hit, that's not nearly as much fun as when I had to actually fight him. And my point is, it can actually kind of ruin it. If you go through a whole game on God mode and then go back and try to play it normally, you're like, well, I've seen everything I'm going to see, and now it's hard. You know, so God mode can be actually pretty dangerous, and as can these combos, where it's like, if I beat Orcus with my big powerhouse group, and now I'm fighting it with gimpy guys because you made me use gimpy guys, well, I already beat Orcus, you know, and now it's just, you know, now I'm just getting beaten up.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is a pretty big challenge, which means that it's important for us as DMs to make sure that first time they fight Orcus, there's still a good challenge there, you know, and you only get that, I think, with a lot of experience. My big tip for how to handle these optimized guys is auras, big ass auras with lots of damage. And because there's hardly anything you can do to an aura, it's going to hit you no matter what. It's going to break through resistances if it's high enough, and it doesn't matter where you are, you're still going to get hit. So, and it doesn't matter if you stun, daze, knock unconscious or whatever, you know, if a guy's got a big aura on, that aura is going to eat you up.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've managed to have a lot of success beating people up with auras. So what other?
I know. I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, but you killed my Hero Slayer Hydra in like
woohoo
9 turns. It was terrible. Yeah, heavy environmentals we talked a lot about. One of the interesting things, you brought up traps and hazards and stuff like that. And one of the things I've been doing is I don't generally count them towards the experience budget anymore. You know, typically traps and hazards had an experience point value that was the equivalent of a monster, but monsters were always far more versatile.
And I just wanted to mention, I threw away the XP budget rules.
Yeah, I actually have to.
I really did. I mean, and for anyone who's listening, you'll get better at creating the encounters. If something's a little too easy, you'll learn from each one. But I'm telling you right now, do not follow those guidelines to a T.
Right.
Or if you do and it comes out to be something insane, don't think that it's going to be an insane encounter.
Yeah, you have to judge it. Right.
Right.
You have to get a feel for how difficult something's going to be. And you're tweaking it on the fly, too. And things that you might think are really hard turn out to be easy and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
What I've started doing is I associate, and I think you probably have read about me doing this, but I award experience after the battle has been fought based on the effort that they put in.
So
if a battle was hard, I will find a monster 2 or 3 levels higher than them and give that amount of experience to each character.
Right.
If a battle was easy, they got less. And it doesn't matter how many monsters I had on the table. You know, if they trivialized it, then they get trivial experience. If they were challenged and it was really hard for them, then they were challenged. So it would mean things like if you had limited healing surges, you know, you've been getting beat up a lot, then a fight that might have been normal is now, you get a lot more experience for succeeding because it was a lot harder fight. And that has worked really well. I still get to give experience points because I like giving experience points. I don't just tell them when they level. I now have a better, you know, DM focused gauge of, I don't have to do a bunch of math. I can just figure out how hard it was and then tell them that's how much they get.
Right.
So that's a good one. What else? So do you have any other kind of big tips for how to keep,
I think DMs really need to learn how to,
what do you do for your solo monsters? Let's get to Schwab's thing and, you know, something I know we've all faced, which is how do you protect solos? What are some of your tips for making sure that your solo monster doesn't get locked down and
traits. And what I mean by traits is, as you've probably noticed in a lot of the newer monsters, it says stuff such as, you know, for instance, if Mike Shea were a solo monster, it would say at the beginning of Mike Shea's turn, he may make a saving throw against stunned and dazed effects, even if it doesn't call for a save.
Right.
I think those help a lot.
Yeah.
The solos having double and triple attacks is extremely potent,
mm-hmm.
But not too overpowering on the players. And options that, you know, push players back and, you know, get them from or target multiple creatures, because I know some marks are extremely brutal.
Right.
It's a tough one. I think there's a bunch of little tidbits. And again, I mean, I know you have a lot of suggestions on your site, Mike. I just want to reiterate that those are pretty good stuff.
Well, I mean,
I think it's definitely influenced the evolution of solo creatures.
Yeah, they're all experimental. I mean,
right.
A lot of the ones I put out there, I put out and tried them, and some of them I use and some of them I don't. You know, one of the things that I haven't seen yet, and I think it's because there's generally a lack of practical experience in Epic Tier, but I think like the Monster Vault Dragons have excellent ways to defend themselves from debilitating status effects.
Just wait for Monster Vault 2.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm looking forward to that. The one thing that I don't think they do particularly well is they're still very limited in what they can get rid of. So it still says like if a Daze, Stunned, or Dominate condition, you know, if they're under a Daze, Stunned, or Dominate condition, they can get rid of their freebie bite attack and remove the condition. But I've seen guys knock out a monster with an unconscious save ends or a petrify save ends. And, you know, there's other debilitating effects that aren't daze, stun, or dominate, like the, you know, like the one that Schwab mentioned, which is a mark, you know, and it's just a mark, except this mark is till the end of the encounter and it dazes and weakens.
And I think that goes back to the original design issues with those powers,
because they're not giving enough power to the DM.
Right.
Yeah. So one of the tricks that I do is they can get rid of any effect that's on them. And as a DM, you have to say, I don't want to be an asshole with this. You know, I don't want to remove something that the player really enjoyed and wasn't that bad. And I've made that mistake, you know, like where they had a daily power that dropped a mark on somebody, and then the monster would, you know, shake off the power right away. And they're like, but that was a daily, you know, like it was a daily sit until the end of the encounter.
Right.
And there wasn't even a saving throw with it, and you got rid of it right away. So, you know, as a DM, you have to kind of be careful to say, like, well, what is that power and how much does it mean to the player? And if it means a lot, then maybe you want to wait a few rounds before you get rid of it. So I think those are good.
I also have tried this out, but it's been relatively successful, but I don't limit my solos the amount of immediate actions they have per round.
Mm, that's interesting.
I just make it unlimited. So if they have, you know, for instance, so if people are provoking left and right, that solo is going to be able to attack them.
Right.
And I think that helps a lot. Now, of course, unless they're stunned, I don't, you know, the stun will still take effect. And one thing that I've had some, you know, crying about, again, Jack Hole DM, even if the monster is dazed, they'll be able to make their one immediate action. So basically the dazed condition turns them, their immediate actions into the normal rules.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. I've done a lot of things like that where if they're stunned, it acts like a daze. And if they're dazed, it acts like a, you know, they lose a minor or a move.
Right.
And I've even let the player decide, like if a player stuns it, it says, okay, you get to choose one of the actions that he doesn't get to use. And they'll say, well, I'm going to pick standard. Or you say, okay, now you get to pick one of the actions they don't get to do when they daze it. And they say, oh, I mean, it's a, of the move or minor. And you say, I want to prevent it from moving. So,
right.
You know, that could work out well. So I think we've covered a lot of ground. I'm hoping that people will find some use in this discussion and then thinking about what they can do for their own. To make sure that they keep the balance high. And also I hope we'll see some stuff come out of Wizards to kind of help people keep their game balance as well. So thank you for spending an hour to talk to me. And
oh, I love it, man. I generally love Dungeons & Dragons. Yeah.
I think we all do. We wouldn't be spending nearly as much time on it as we are.
Heck yeah, man. So anytime you want to chat about something, let me know.
We'll do this again.
Absolutely.